Go.
The episodes with you are like, did you ever see Wayne's World? And when Harry Shearer is interviewing Wayne and Garth, and he's like clearly not listening, and they're just like going on and on. And I'm like,
All right, our special guests right now, Wayne Campbell, Garth Elgar, Wayne's World. All right, talking about Wayne Stock, very exciting, big event. Everybody's excited, huh?
Yeah, it's going to be a big concert at Adlai Stevenson Park.
Uh-huh.
It's just going to be a big party, you know? We've got some great bands coming.
Uh-huh.
Like Aerosmith.
Uh-huh.
I just want to remind everybody that there's still plenty of tickets left.
Uh-huh.
But that's no reason to wait till the last minute.
Uh-huh.
Because it's just a chance for the city of Aurora.
Mm-hmm.
To do something.
Uh-huh.
Fun.
Uh-huh.
And to put the city on the map.
Mm-hmm.
It's a lot of work.
Oh, well, work is hard.
You're not really listening to me, are you?
Uh-huh.
I mean, I could say anything right now, like you're a complete tool.
Mm-hmm.
But you wouldn't hear it, because you're a freak with a microphone.
Uh-huh.
It's not even challenging anymore. It's like shooting fish in a barrel. Isn't that true, Sphincter boy?
Uh-huh. What?
Oh!
They're getting closer all the time. All right, good information about Wayne Stock.
But, like, I am listening. It's just that you're so good at, like, talking, and you have this, like, kind of linear style, and you obviously have taken great notes. It's not like rambling Magoo over here and his Wanderlust, you know, inside his brain. But you have, like, an ordered way of things, which is good for podcasts, believe me. Well, Chris... That was an intro of intros. Welcome back to the show. You are now my indentured laborer, apparently, always coming on my show.
Well, this is definitely the last one, because after this, everything I know will be will be documented. This is everything
yes, that's
I
true.
Know. It's over now.
So. Okay. So. This, we've promised this episode for a while. It is, we're talking about the Troubles. The Troubles. These are, it's something that I used to hear a lot about it in the news. Obviously, like, I think our lives caught the tail end of it in the sense that, like, when we became kind of, I think we're around the similar age. And, like, when we were, like, you know, I'm sure you heard about it way more than me, obviously, being where you live. But in terms of, like, how it came into, like, the international Anglophone news media, it was a topic that was, you know, often enough. And in other ways, too, culturally and music and stuff like that. And then, you know, it just kind of went away. So we're here to talk about the Troubles. How do we start? What's the plan, Professor?
Well, I think that, you know, like I finished off the Connolly episode after the 1916 Rising, and it would be a bit insane if my first contribution tried to cover 50 years of Irish history. So we'll just cover 55. I'll send you a blog post after this that'll maybe make the transition a little bit easier for anyone who wants to follow along for the War of Independence that I wrote a while ago. But it is kind of important to cover this because the roots of it do kind of go back that far. So I'll just race through this intro and then I'll give you a place to come in. Does that sound all right? So the War of Independence and the political organization that fought it or led it, Sinn Féin, had been an umbrella movement. And under very specific circumstances, it had brought together monarchists, nationalists, and republican separatists within a single unified front for national liberation. But once serious discussions about the nature of the Irish state, which was being struggled for, began to be posed during the treaty negotiations which followed the May 1921 truce, these different factions within the organisation began to enter into open conflict. It was Cumann na Mban member Mary McSweeney, and Cumann na Mban was the women's section of the IRA, began to detect a more conciliatory tone coming into the leadership around this time, noting that Michael Collins, who was the leader of the IRB, the Irish Republican Brotherhood, which was this like secret society within the IRA, did not make it. Michael Collins, sorry, just to go back to the start of the sentence, Michael Collins did not make any references to the Republic while delivering a speech in Armagh. And those Republicans who were later to take up arms against the Free State remember the appearance of newspaper articles outlining the benefits of things like Dominion status, the nature of the Commonwealth membership, which was enjoyed by Canadians, and the impossibility overall of renewing the armed struggle to fight for the Republic in its entirety. And Republicans such as Ernie O'Malley remember a lot of people joining the army after the ceasefire and speaking very very fervently for settlement with the Brits, and these factions were referred to as Trusaliers. Liam Mallows, who is a journalist and a veteran of the abortive 1916 rising in Galway, expected negotiations with the British to break down and continued his work in procuring arms from overseas. This wavering of confidence in the capacity of the constitutional movement to deliver the Republic was also present in the leadership. Col Brua, who was a senior figure, refused to form part of the Irish delegation going to negotiate the treaty. Within this negotiating faction, there was actually divisions. Collins and Arthur Griffith, on certain issues, made common cause with the Brits against the others, with the British cabinet against the other members of the delegation. Griffiths was in secret correspondence with Lloyd George, the British Prime Minister, about the role that the British monarch might play in Irish affairs into the future. So, you know, not something that would have been very popular among all those Republicans who had been taking up arms against the Brits over the past number of years. The objectives of the British cabinet were obvious, because if they allowed the Irish to leave the empire all the way, this would strengthen the hand of these independence movements in India and Egypt. The British had also been proactive, of course, in securing their position in the north all the way along. The 1920 Government of Ireland Act, don't know what's wrong with my voice today. The 1920 Government of Ireland Act created the statelet of Northern Ireland, quote unquote, out of the counties of Antrim, Armagh, Derry, Down, Fermanagh and Tyrone. The Loyalists demand for the six counties, as opposed to the proper nine counties of Ulster, the historic province, was based on their calculation that they wouldn't be able to maintain control of the Catholic majorities beyond those of Fermanagh and Tyrone. And over the summer of 1920, Loyalist leaders had encouraged pogroms against Catholics, which began in Belfast and then continued sporadically over the summer. And by the end of the summer, 16 Catholics had been killed and nearly 200 houses and shops had been burned. A boycott of goods produced by unionist firms in Belfast was passed in the Dáil. So ultimately, this treaty did place significant limitations on Irish self-determination. They allowed Britain to retain control of Irish ports. They required all parliamentarians in the Dáil to swear an oath of allegiance to the British monarch. And they didn't bring any change in the imposed border. And Éamon de Valera and Col Brua were the most prominent anti-treaty figures within Sinn Féin, but they weren't leading the tenancy. Republicans who took against the treaty were themselves hugely divided. There's a great line from Liam Lowes, who I'd already mentioned. Mallows argued, and Mallows believed, that the 1919 election which had taken place was the authentic mandate. The treaty wasn't. And this election mandate, the will of the Irish people, was being held hostage by British propaganda and by threats of an invasion. In the treaty debates he said, quote, "The people are being stampeded. In the people's minds there is only one alternative to this treaty, and that is terrible, immediate war. That is not the will of the people. That is the fear of the people." Great line. So while these debates were taking place and the arguments were raging within the Republican movement as to what strategy to adopt in order to combat the treaty, Lloyd George establishes the Ulster Special Constabulary, or B Specials, which is a paramilitary colonial force modelled on Mussolini's Fascisti. Under the dictatorial powers that Craig secured in the Special Powers Act, the B Specials were indemnified against prosecution, while Sinn Féin, the IRA and Cumann na Mban all became proscribed organisations in the six counties. And by mid-1922, there was one armed policeman for every two Catholic families. And during the first months of, I already covered actually the pogroms that were taking place. But in effect, you have a pro-treaty side who was willing to accept dominion within the British Empire, oaths of loyalty to the king, British youths of ports, remittances, so compensation for Brits who were quote-unquote losing their land, you know, land that they had acquired through conquest, they were being compensated for it. And on the other side, you then had a Republican cohort who stood for the All-Ireland Republic declared in 1916. And to cut a long story short, through a brutal campaign of repression, summary execution and imprisonment, the latter movement, the Republican movement, was neutralised by those in favour of establishing a free state. After the Civil War, Éamon de Valera, a veteran of 1916 who took the anti-treaty side, I've already mentioned him a couple of times, he formed a new political party called Fianna Fáil. And they contested the 1927 election on a programme of land redistribution and the restoration of the Irish language. And in doing so, De Valera initiates a pattern, which we see consistently and we will see consistently, as a Republican movement within the Free State that initially regarded as illegitimate, enters its parliament, accommodates itself to it and to its parliaments and to its institutions, and get swallowed up by the state and become incorporated into it. And Fianna Fáil becomes the 26-county state natural party of government, despite them being composed of the rump of the Republican movement. And one of the ironies of this is that they themselves then institute the, or set in motion and victimize, sorry, what am I trying to say here? They initiate the same policies that they would have suffered themselves when they regarded the state as illegitimate, like internment and execution. And all throughout the 30s and 40s, you see Fianna Fáil imprisoning Republicans en masse. And those who remain unreconciled to the state, stay within the IRA, regard themselves as the legitimate army of the All-Ireland Republic. They are overwhelmingly working class. Many of them will have been imbued with a Republican heritage in their families. And they would have all been very conscious of the historical struggle for Irish freedom from a young age. And this, as well as veterans of the conflict who remain politically active, is how the tradition continues through a decade-long period of counter-revolution. Because after the treaty was passed, TDs and the Second Dáil had formed an emergency government with the support of the rank-and-file membership of the IRA. And they were, in their view, the true government of the Irish Republic. The Dáil did not have the authority, in their view, to liquidate itself by passing the treaty, by accepting the Brits' limitations on Irish sovereignty. And over the years, this executive council met as a shadow government. And by 1938, you had Count Plunkett, whose son Joseph Plunkett was one of the seven signatories of the 1916 proclamation. Mary McSweeney, sister of Terence McSweeney, and a very formidable Republican activist in her own right, and Tom Maguire. And these all transferred their sovereignty to the IRA in 1938. So on that basis, the IRA became the de jure government of the Republic. This is very important. For a lot of the people we're going to be talking about, they can draw a direct line between the organizations they are a part of and the Second Dáil, which they regard as being illegally liquidated, that is the authentic mandate of the Irish Republic. It's pretty weighty, it's pretty heavy, and some historians actually kind of pick holes in the lineage, but they would do that. The point is, for our purposes, that's what they think they're doing. And that's what they hold to be the objective of what they're setting out to do. So in the history of republicanism or anti-imperialism in Ireland, you see the terms by which the Republic is to be brought about go through these cycles. The Rising was more or less exclusively a military action. But over the War of Independence, you had political and social agitation coming into the frame at the same time. You had civilians building the political and civic infrastructure of the state, creating a situation of dual power, where the broad mass of the population had a really crucial part to play. In the Civil War, the Republicans who opposed the treaty, very much on the, more on the military side of things, they took up a garrison in the forecourts. They didn't really seek to involve some of the labour agitation that was going on at the time. They didn't seek to maybe broaden it out into another social strata beyond the military organisation, which might have been partly why it failed. But during the counter-revolution in the 30s, socialists like Pádraig O'Donnell and George Gilmore call for the bringing together of Irish republicanism with militant socialism. Frank Ryan, another IRA man, goes to fight in the Spanish Civil War. And a lot of the time this led to anti-communist or Red Scare politics, both within the movement and in society at large, like clerical and reactionary forces, proto-fascist forces. So there are always contradictory and competing tendencies at work in the republican movement. And those who rebuilt it again in the 40s were kind of suspicious of political agitation. And in the late 50s, early 60s represented another turn to political struggle in the wake of military defeat or failure. And the last major IRA campaign before the Troubles break out was in 1956. And this was the border campaign. The IRA had undertaken a bombing campaign in England in the 40s. And this represented an attempt to end partition by carrying out operations within the heart of darkness.
Once again, London has been shocked by two more deliberate attempts to destroy property and endanger life. Two underground stations have to be temporarily closed. A station foreman lies in hospital, seriously injured. These close-ups inside the station give you an idea of the force of the explosion. The police appear to be convinced that these latest outrages are again the work of politicians of the underworld. Every right-thinking man and woman will condemn this insolent, insane attempt at terrorism, which strikes at the very root of the freedom and safety of democracy.
Attacks on British infrastructure, or you see in B Specials barracks in Fermanagh, Derry and Tyrone, because the IRA had made the decision that the 26-county Free State would not be challenged or attacked in the same way. An important man in developing this military strategy, his name was Sean Cronin. He came from the Kerry Gaeltacht and he had been in the Free State Army. And he played a huge role in raising the IRA to the level where they were militarily capable again. You had bombings of courthouses, you had firings on police barracks, you had BBC transmitters getting blown up, and there were around 150 volunteers involved. In response to these attacks, internment is reintroduced in the six counties. British Army troops are stationed in County Down, and Sinn Féin were made an illegal organisation. I wonder, were they made an illegal organisation again? Or maybe they weren't prescribed the first time properly, I'm not sure. So, concurrent with the escalation of the border campaign, you also had the development of the IRA's political organisation, Sinn Féin. And during its Ardesh in 1950, they passed a motion that, quote, social justice based on Christian principles by a just distribution of effective control of the nation's wealth and resources would be one of its aims. And they put forward an abstentionist candidate in a by-election in Louth in 1954. And abstentionism is an important principle because the IRA don't recognise the legitimacy of institutions on either side of the border. Both are products of British imperialism. They repress the institutions or government of the Irish Republic. So when they contest elections in either state, that they pledge not to take their seats. Local government is exempt from this. It was regarded as being possible to serve the people in local government without compromising on these principles. Now, the border campaign, of course, ended in failure. A lot of imprisonments, a lot of martyrs, and by its end, the extent of the demoralisation within the IRA was such that it had been whittled down to just 120 members, only around 50 fully fledged volunteers, and apparently they were unable to fill a minibus to head down to an Easter commemoration in Dublin. So it was really, really moribund. And this brought about something like a political or strategic reorientation within the IRA. Carl Goulding, who was a tradesman from Dublin, had been arrested during a weapon smuggling operation in Britain and was in prison during the border campaign. So he wasn't quite as tainted by its failure as others were. And while he was in prison, he came into contact with a Soviet spy named Klaus Fuchs, who was a member of the National Organization of Cypriot Fighters, YOCA, and he began to read about the Russian Revolution and about the history of socialist struggle. Goulding also became close to a number of communist intellectuals who followed a Stalinist analysis of the national question, which argued that a broad front of mass campaigns working through parliaments had to take place in order for the situation in Ireland to be resolved. And one important part of this analysis was that there would be a new centrality afforded to the Protestant working class in bringing about a transformation of Irish society along socialist lines. And history and current events would lead us to think of the unionist population in the six counties as being maybe a labour aristocracy, lining up with those in power. Elements in the IRA who would later form the officials emphasised the importance of not alienating them with Republican iconography or tactics. The Trinity College lecturer Roy Johnston, who had Carl Goulding's ear, argued the Republican commemorations were sectarian and it turned unionists who might otherwise be sympathetic to their aims off. You had people like Billy McKee, who had been more traditional Republicans, left the IRA at this stage and saw it as incompatible with the situation in the North and the nature of Stormont as it existed then. But it's important to understand that the IRA was not in any sense monolithic. There would have been a lot of contending and contradictory elements. There would have been awareness of national liberation struggles in Algeria, Cuba and Vietnam. And likewise, there were elements who were fervently anti-communist. In their history of the IRA, or the official IRA at least, Brian Hanley and Scott Miller write about Sean South, who died during the border campaign, but apparently wrote letters to newspapers about the nefarious influence of communists in Hollywood. So on this basis, Goulding and another man named Sean Garland, who was very much his ally in strategically reorienting the Republican movement, had to move carefully and challenge different parts of the IRA's founding principles piecemeal in order to keep the movement together. Now, having said that, he attempted to liquidate or disband Cumann na mBan at first, which is the women's section of Sinn Féin, denouncing them as a source of reactionary ideas because they objected to a Connolly banner at a commemoration in Bonestown. Richard Bell was kicked out for firing a rocket at a British ship docked in Waterford. But it's important to remember as well that Rory O'Brody, who was often held up as being at the core of this traditional Republican element, had a keen interest in social policies such as cooperatives and nationalising industry. He had been involved in land agitation and him and Johnson had collaborated on a social program, Erenua, which was based on the Breton laws, repudiated both American capitalism and Moscow-style socialism, and kind of had Julius Nyerere's African socialism more as a touchstone. So from O'Brody's point of view, and maybe from ours, this is not really a disagreement about socialist politics as such, but a dispute on the recognition of partitionist parliaments, whether or not you could or should work through the institutions of the state in order to achieve your goals. And O'Brady and others recognised that what was at stake in this argument was the conversion of the Republican movement into a constitutional rather than a revolutionary organisation. Okay, we're just about to start into the actual troubles now. That's just all the scene setting. So while all this is going on, Catholics and nationalists in the North are beginning to agitate for civil rights and state recognition that the Orange State were not granting them. And the Northern Ireland Civil Rights Association, or NICRA, is founded in January 1967. The six-county state was not a democracy for the Catholics who lived in it. Electoral boundaries were drawn in such a way that ensured that even in areas when there was a clear nationalist majority, they had no place on councils, they were underemployed, they had no access to public housing.
These pictures were taken in Fintan County, Tyrone, not in order to arouse national or social hatreds, but in order to expose part of a system of discrimination imposed with the connivance of the British government. It is imposed in order to maintain partition against the wishes of the majority of the Irish people. Mr. Campbell of Mill Street and some of his children, 8 people live here. Mrs. Mullen of Mill Street has 8 children all living here. Big families and little houses are normal in these back streets of Fintana. 2/3 of the people of this little town are nationalists. That is to say, they are in favour of unity with the rest of Ireland and against being treated as part of Britain. Here at Craigavon Park, not one house went to a nationalist. Craigavon Park is unionist, and unionist it must stay. Only an informed public opinion can destroy the structure of injustice which here in Fintana and throughout the partition territory sustains the unnatural division of Ireland.
On the 5th of October 1968, the Minister for Home Affairs, William Craig, bans a scheduled NICRA march. When it goes ahead, it was stopped by the RUC outside the city gates, and the crowd were attacked with batons and 100 people were injured. Another march in January 1969 ended at Burntollet Bridge in Derry when a mob supported by the RUC attacked marchers with stones and studded sticks. The RUC then went into Catholic area of the Bogside and rioted, conducted raids on houses, beat people with batons and all this. And this is of a part with the brutal campaign of violence that the Crown Forces mete out against the population, and it plays an enormous role in delegitimising the Orange State. The delegitimation that's going to take place over the next number of years.
Newry, the Northern Ireland border town, was another scene of violence in a black weekend. What started as a peaceful civil rights march turned into a battlefield. Despite appeals by march leaders for no violence, trouble flared when steel-helmeted police altered the marchers' route to exclude a Protestant area of the town. As a protest, the marchers refused to take the alternative route. It resulted first in deadlock, then violence. The fighting raged into the early dusk. Demonstrators captured and burned 5 single-deck police buses and pushed another into a canal. The police watched silently and did not intervene. 20 people were eventually arrested at the end of this violent day. 5 policemen were reported injured.
So despite the claims being made by the Stormont regime, there were individual Republicans, though there were individual Republicans present within the organisation, NICRA was not an IRA front. Its slogan was British rights for British citizens. For figures like Goulding and others who were in favour of parliamentary activity, moving away from military tactics, the emergence of a mass movement which was not focused on the ending of partition seemed to justify their analysis of the situation. But then, in August 1969, you have loyalist mobs in Belfast attacking Catholic areas. There are burnings and hundreds of families are being forced out of their homes. Many of these flee over the border and into the 26 counties. And the RUC, who participate and direct these attacks, are armed with machine guns. And you get events like a 9-year-old Catholic boy being killed in Divis Street, which is just off the Falls Road, which is kind of at the centre of the nationalist part of Belfast.
Outside the barricades, the wreckage from the recent rioting continued to be demolished. Even in the ruins, children find some consolation. These Protestant schoolboys have gone into the scrap metal business, looting empty Catholic houses.
What have you been doing in there?
Looking for copper, lead and brass.
Looking for what?
Copper, lead and brass.
Copper, lead and brass?
Yes.
Well, how much you get for copper, lead and brass then?
You get 50 bob for a stone of copper, 12 bob for a stone of lead.
35 bob for the copper, a stone of copper pipe.
You're from the Protestant area, all you boys, are you?
Protestant, yes.
And all these are all Catholic houses here?
Yes.
Nobody left?
No.
Check one.
Show me what you've been getting then.
It's here.
Yeah. Hey, you. Hold on.
Well, look, here's copper tape. From, stove or something. Like that.
Yeah.
And there's tape.
How much is these two bags worth? How much money will you get for these then?
£3.
£3?
Yeah.
What are you doing with this money?
Spend it.
Yeah. What are you spending it on?
Yeah.
Well, do you think any Catholic boys are getting any of the same things out of Protestant houses?
Yes, sir. Yeah.
What?
Yeah.
Look at them over in Derry.
Over in Derry, it's kind of a house.
Do you feel sorry for these people who have been thrown out of their houses?
No.
No.
What?
No.
Why don't you feel sorry?
They're always only starting trouble. That's all they ever do.
Belfast Republicans and Nationalists might have expected the IRA to be capable of defending these areas. And while Billy McKee, who I mentioned, and Gerard McCauley from na Fianna Éireann, which is another Republican organisation, were there, these pogroms and these attacks demonstrated just how ill-equipped the IRA were to protect from Loyalist incursions. So that's kind of how it all starts. I don't know if you want to come in at that stage.
Well, it's interesting. It's like, I'm listening to all of this. Obviously, it's a lot for people who aren't specialists, but it's so familiar for anyone who can recognize like other examples of like apartheid and like race war. And, it's sort of like a general like case study in, British colonial race politics, right? Like, where one class of people are situated above another class, and like the emphasis, I mean, it's crazy, like what Northern Ireland is throughout most of the 20th century, as meanwhile, like the luminaries of like the British imperial system are talking about, establishing democracy in Egypt and establishing democracy here. I mean, it's like complete, the naked hypocrisy of just like, even in their own back door is so pure in the British context, because it is so. And, another thing was, I was thinking too, is like confronting what to do with partition, like goes to like the brass tacks of a revolutionary movement. How much do you want to confront this thing that might take our lives? I mean, maybe that's a misreading, but they certainly saw that like confronting sort of like the actual partition itself, like would mean insurrectionary war, like all the time. Like, because the Brits weren't going to just give them up, were they? Like in theory.
No,
like they would have to be forced out.
Absolutely not. Absolutely not. They wouldn't. They would have to be forced. And it's really interesting, because what happens, because I mentioned that there were refugees being forced across the border, is that it puts it in the face of a state built on partition, whose existence is kind of difficult to explain. This mentality of partitionism. This change in your mindset that makes you forget that this is something that is being done to your country as well. But all too often in Irish history, the ruling class of the 26 counties, the Comprador bourgeoisie, are allowed to pretend that they're Irish and deny that Irishness to nationalists and Protestants on the other side of the border. And
which is essentially giving in to the British imperialist world system of like, here are these different collection of nations that we play together in this symphony of our power and it's like it goes back again to the laboratory of empire, like even in their departure and like the social technology of partition, like it really comes once again on the Irish to sort of like, for the Brits to kind of like experiment again. I mean, maybe that's not legal. Maybe that's not completely true. Maybe there are previous partitions. I'm not sure, but certainly like what happens in India, what happens in Palestine, this is a global story of partition. And it seems that like the Irish were like early players in it.
Absolutely. The example of just how deep this crisis becomes when violence begins to break out and there's this new fear that civil war is going to spill out over the border again. You get the then Taoiseach, the Prime Minister of the 26 counties, Jack Lynch, making a televised address saying that the Irish people could no longer stand idly by. And there were field hospitals being set up along the border for refugees. And people interpret Lynch's comments as being that they were going to send the army of the Free State across the border. That was probably never on the table, but that's how people, such as the kind of the fervor of the moment, a number of Republicans thought that partition is over. Things are being destabilized to the extent that there could be an annexation and a reoccupation of the six counties by the Irish state. So figures like Sean McStiafon and O'Brady, who I mentioned, are trying to take advantage of the situation by beginning the armed campaign, acting as armed defence units in nationalist areas, and carrying out reprisals against security forces. But Goulding opposed them on the basis of the idea that this would alienate Protestant opinion. He says, it is not our job to be Catholic defenders. So elements that would compose the provisional split, this is where it might get more familiar to some of your listeners. I'm sure everyone's heard of the provos. Take the initiative and begin to carry out raids on REC barracks and start to obtain weapons. And actually, there's a good line here, just to double back a little bit, that gives them kind of their mission statement, if you like. I mentioned the bombing campaign that the IRA were carrying out in England in the 40s. So the bodies of Peter Barnes and James McCormick, who were two Republicans who were hanged in English prisons, their bodies are repatriated. And there's a graveside oration where the provisional side of the split set out their stall, if you like. So I'll just read it. Our two martyred comrades went forth to carry the fight to the enemy into enemy territory, using the only methods that will ever succeed. Not the methods of politicians, nor the constitutionalists, but the method of soldiers, the method of armed force. The ultimate aim of the Irish nation will never emerge from political or constitutional platform. One is now expected to be more conversant with the teaching of Chairman Mao than with those of our dead patriots. So that you get a sense of the kind of the politics there. So the actual breaking point, the moment at which these two factions in the IRA pull apart, is when a motion on dropping abstention and leaving the way open for Sinn Féin to stand for elections in Leinster House, Westminster and Stormont. The abstentionists, the provos, walk out and form a new executive on the basis that those who had favoured dropping abstention had avoided their membership of the IRA. The split was kind of uneven geographically. Most people in Dublin stayed with the officials, while the provos were more rural in character. Derry was an official stronghold. Belfast was kind of 50-50. And there would have been a few going to both and then moving back because the provos and the officials were competing with each other. So they were carrying out armed action because they still wanted members and they still wanted credibility. Gerry Adams was in the officials and then moved over into the provos, just by the by. So there was no objection in the provos to the idea of a workers' republic. They weren't against socialism, even though they took the piss out of people for being too into Chairman Mao and not enough into James Connolly or whatever. Particularly among a younger generation of recruits. But there was little understanding of how they might combine it with armed struggle. We all know about Mao's armed campaign or about Che Guevara's approach, where it was kind of easier in maybe a mass peasantry kind of situation to thread those two things. But there was no scope in an urban area or in a country where kind of large farmers predominate in the south to have a guerrilla campaign run through the necessary sequence of stages, where you control particular areas and then go from there. Because most of the fighting was happening in Belfast, which is an urban place. Smaller rural armed service units had their uses because they were hard to penetrate. They were based of kind of friend groups. You know, you didn't get into those organizations. You didn't get into those cells if you didn't know those people personally. But they couldn't inflict very many casualties on the Brits because they weren't out in the countryside. So escalating the campaign from a defensive to an offensive one consisted of carrying out bombings in Belfast city centre, making it too expensive for the British to maintain their presence in the six counties. And this is probably the iconic image of the IRA campaign that everyone would be familiar with, the idea of cars blowing up in a city centre. So when they first came in, the British Army were not regarded with hostility across the broad mass of the population. They thought they'd be better or more even-handed than the RUC. Though Republicans would have regarded them as the enemy or the occupying force, this wouldn't have been a generally held view at first. Because a significant number of Catholics had actually joined the British Army because of the high levels of unemployment among Catholics in Belfast. And this attitude obviously changed significantly after Bloody Sunday, which you've probably heard of. So on the day of Bloody Sunday itself, 20,000 people show up to an anti-internment march, which had been banned. The crowd throw stones at British troops, and they're met with CS gas and rubber bullets, and then 26 unarmed people are shot. 13 die there and then, and a 14th dies later. The British Army claimed that they were fired upon, that everyone who died had been identified prior to the march being involved in seditious activity. And of course, these were all lies. Bernadette Devlin, who had stood for election in Derry and had been elected to Westminster, punched the British Home Secretary Reginald Maudling in the chamber after he made a statement lying about what had transpired that day. The Prime Minister Edward Heath suspended Stormont and established his direct rule over the six counties. Lord Widgery, member of the British nobility, produces a report that argues the responsibilities for the deaths lie with those who organised the march, and that the commanding officer of the Parachute Regiment, Derek Wilford, who killed these people, should be exonerated from blame, and he later received an order of the British Empire. The commanding officer, Michael Jackson, became chief of the General Staff and was not called upon to answer for his testimony. It was not called upon in his testimony to answer for the fact that his handwriting was all over every soldier's written testimony. And similarly, you had Frank Kitson, who had served in Kenya when the British Army were waging their brutal campaign of counterinsurgency against the Mau Mau, was there and has never had to answer for his crimes. And I think he became the head of MI5 at some stage. So the British establishment completely insulated the Parachute Regiment from blame, refused to consider the Ballymurphy massacre from a few months before, in which 9 Catholic civilians were shot dead. And you had many of the same soldiers involved in that atrocity as well. And families are still seeking justice and prosecutions to this day. So all throughout this period, the ruling class in the 26 counties are tremendously nervous about the outbreak of civil war and the spilling over of the conflict across the border, because initially any Republican strategy in the 26 is confined to a few robberies. But after Bloody Sunday, you get protests outside the British Embassy in the centre of Dublin, and a man is interviewed on the television calling the British murdering bastards. And based on the number of vigils and strikes and walkouts which begins, this seems, you can safely say that this was a generalised sentiment. 2,000 workers walk off from the Shannon Industrial Estate. They go to the Shannon Airport Terminal. They demand that the tricolour be lowered to half-mast. Dockers in Cork board a British ship and force it to fly a black flag. You have textile, chemical, car factory workers all walking out across the island, Dundalk, Sligo, Waterford, Limerick, Ringsend, Glasnevin, that you had them calling for a general strike on the day of the funerals. And all those workers who were in Dublin converge on the British Embassy carrying black flags and coffins. And a lot of this would be happening spontaneously and often against the will of the more moderate trade union leadership. So there's a very stark polarization of attitudes suddenly. Among the parties composing the Free States 2.5 party system, not organizations known for their staunchness on this stuff, you get the Lord Mayor of Cork, T.J. O'Sullivan, I think it was Labour Party. He said, if they want murder, they'll have murder. One of theirs will go for each of ours. You have Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael TDs speaking openly about finishing the job our boy started in 1916. I haven't looked into this closely enough to say whether or not this was a matter of the political temperature, whether they were stoking public opinion in order to put themselves in a position where they'd be able to channel it later. But the latter would certainly tend to be more their MO. So Jack Lynch announces a day of mourning. The walkouts continue. Electricity workers, busmen, teachers, students. In Sandyford, which is a very wealthy suburb in the south of Dublin, you have housewives denouncing the new black and tans. A lorry is driven into the cops' lines. They're protecting the embassy. Petrol bombs and a Gelignite bomb is thrown at the embassy as well. So on the actual day of mourning, a lot of this activity continues. The public broadcaster is exclusively putting out material relating to the rising and the history of the Irish independence struggle. British flags are burnt at another rally at the embassy, at which the Irish Republican Socialist Party founder Seamus Costello makes a speech, calls for the cops to step aside and allow the crowd to burn the bastards out. And at this stage, the embassy is burnt down. And there's a march then to Mountjoy to demand the release of the provisional IRA men who were imprisoned there. Now, all of this, I think, tallies with what we might understand as being kind of a revolutionary situation. And certainly it's kind of hard to deny it in some ways. But then on the other, very quickly, things calm down in the 26 counties. The Dublin Monaghan bombing 2 years later gives the opportunity for the state and its reactionary apparatus to really kick into gear. I think people's maybe desire for stabilities and their fear as well allows them to compartmentalize the struggle, pretend it isn't happening. But long story short, a series of bombs go off in Dublin city center and then in Monaghan town. And this is the worst atrocity in the history of the conflict. 37 people are killed, and though it wasn't clear at the time, it's subsequently come out that this was directed at the highest levels of British intelligence. And this isn't, this isn't one of those Gladio things where, you know, we all know Gladio is real, but it's kind of a lot more murky. This is, you know, a tested fact. MI5 trained loyalist death squads and British Army men to carry this killing out, to kill Irish civilians, to prevent them from lobbying for change or to call on the Brits to evacuate the North. The Fine Gael Labour governments are able to turn this to their advantage. They blame it on the IRA. They introduce laws and juryless courts to crack down on socialists, Republicans, people either participating in the struggle or regarded as being sympathetic. Because defendants would often have been acquitted by supportive juries. So you get the introduction of Section 31. This prevents Republicans from being interviewed on the public broadcaster. And this was purged of elements regarded as being sympathetic. Special branch and the cops all get additional powers. More than 8,000 people are arrested. More than 1,500 people are charged. There are many accounts of people being tortured in custody, deprived of sleep to extract falsified confessions under duress. And this is sort of how the kibosh is put on any form of cross-border solidarity. And the partitionism that you asked about is kind of further entrenched. Sad. Yeah,
it's there is this nagging thing that in the back of my head sometimes that when I listen to sort of when I learn from you, which is and it's gonna sound worse than I actually mean, but like the scale of the history in terms of, and again this sounds weird but it's true, that like the scale of the body count is like pretty is like in terms of like the numbers that I'm used to, right? Like a Bloody Sunday is like 2 days in Palestine today. Like, and I don't mean that to like cheapen the value of anything. Of course not. Like, obviously, like this is, it's part of a global history of like basically like British imperial terror. On the one hand, it's like more direct in the Irish case, whereas later on, it's, you know, it's subcontracted to, you know, Zionist soldiers, which are, you know, a part of the British imperial project, if not directly. I mean, they're part of the American one, which is a continuation. So these are not separate histories, but it's just, to me, to my mind, one of the things here is the scale of this, is that like Ireland is such a small country, but it's had this really powerful rippling effect in terms of understanding of history. Like there's, I don't know, like it just, I said this in an episode with the Irish MEPs, Mick and Claire, and I said, like, Ireland sort of like punches above its weight culturally, historically, in the sense of like its own history has been so, I don't know, fraught, but also in a sort of embedded into our cultural views. Anyways, this is a rambling thing because I have no real contribution to make to what you're saying, because like the history is obviously like way more. But it's just that from a distance, I can't help but think sometimes, like, yeah, like the body count here is pretty small and tense, but then it's not a much smaller country than Palestine, but I don't know. Like, that's just my first thought, which is like a weird thing to think, albeit like, I feel weird saying that, like, well, but it's just, yeah.
Well, you do yourself a bit of a disservice saying it doesn't have anything to contribute. I mean, there's commonalities in terms of what you're saying about the farming out of the American imperial project that Zionists are responsible for conducting. And that's certainly an important part of the British military strategy that I was just about to come on to. But it strikes me too, right, in terms of the 70s and the period of time that we're talking about how more open things seemed in terms of these sorts of struggles and how active these international networks of solidarity were, and in very material ways. Like, you know, you could, there's one incident, I think, at some point in all this, where a couple of members of a Republican organization go into the House of Commons and fuck a smoke grenade into the British parliamentary chamber. Like, you have an elected representative from the occupied territories of Ireland punching a member of the British cabinet. And, you know, we look now at Palestine and Iraq and Iran and all those areas of pushback that used to be so active, and all these state building projects, they've just been totally decimated. And I mean, this is a bit of a doomer point, and people you've had on your podcast before who know much more about these movements than I do, and these organizations as they operate now than I do, like, it just seems like the body count of imperialism is just, as horrible as this was, there are certainly events every day that would match it or exceed it, you know.
Which, of course, again, to reiterate, like, it doesn't minimize the loss of lives, it doesn't minimize the scale of the terror, but it's interesting to see. And again, sounds grosser, but it's like a small scale miniature of, like, this immensely violent and, like, bloody global history of using sectarianism, like, all the pieces, at least, that you would see in other countries as well, like, are apparent in the sort of 20th century history of Ireland, right? And again, it just repeat that damn thing again and again. It is a lab, and it is a place to sort of, like, understand at least the logics. And maybe that's because of its, like, smaller nature, that, like, the conflagration points are relatively, like, not minor, I don't want to say that, but, like, you know, they're you know, it's a pretty tight history of struggle, even if it does extend over decades. Is that we're talking about, like, a pretty, like, small but, like, closed off piece of land, because it's an island, obviously. But you know, I don't know, I also can't help but think that, like, this is also the story of terrorism, like what we call today terrorism, right? Like, so much of what we understand about modern terrorism is connected to the Irish struggle for against partition, right? And whether for good or for bad. And it's funny, terrorism as a word has gone away from our lives, like, it, especially compared to, like, 15 years ago, like, in the post 9/11 life, but, like, in the direct light of 9/11 and that kind of, like, hysterical era. But terrorism is also an important tool of British imperialism, as the Irish case makes clear, as, you know, the whole history of the entire world makes clear. Like, the biggest terrorist actors are these imperialist states, because of the nature of because of the nature of their weapons and the nature of their violence, is that it benefits the imperial power to sow anarchy. So it's interesting in the case of Ireland, is that you have you have a kind of appropriation of the tools of British imperialism thrown back at the occupier. Like, you get what you eventually get what you give out.
Yeah, for sure. And this, I mean, to go back to what you said in terms of the laboratory, in terms of the test case, you know, I mentioned Frank Kitson, whose book, Low Intensity Operations, I haven't read very recently, but it's the one-stop shop in terms of how these counterinsurgency operations are waged. And he learned on the job from the Mau Mau, and the Brits put into practice what he laid down in the six counties. And this all plays into the policy of Ulsterization. See, at the beginning of the campaign, it looked as though the Brits might be pushed out of Belfast. British Army soldiers had little sense of the geography. They were easy to put into ambushes, but gradually the occupying forces become more familiar with these areas, particularly after they'd erected an armed cordon around the city centre, and this controlled the traffic in and out. Towards the end of 1974, the Brits start to engage with the IRA on withdrawal, saying that they are preparing to withdraw and get around the table. And as long as the IRA agree to a ceasefire, these talks can go on. Now, there is an enormous amount of back and forth here. The ceasefire is broken and re-engaged, and the officials, or the Irish National Liberation Army, break it. It's all covered very well in Ed Maloney's book, A Secret History of the IRA. I'm not going to cover everything here, but suffice it to say, the ceasefire seems to have been a bit of a strategic mistake, and a stalling tactic on behalf of the British, because they were building the H blocks while they were talking about withdrawal. So they were using this delay in military action to develop their intelligence networks, and what I've said already, Ulsterization, where the conflict would be contained to the six counties and conducted by armed proxies such as loyalist paramilitaries, loyalist paramilitaries like the Ulster Defence Association or UDA, the Ulster Freedom Fighters, UFF, and their political wings, the DUP, the Democratic Unionist Party.
These are jihadis. No, really. I mean, it's the same technology. You find like the most reactionary force and you use them as a wedge, as like a cudgel.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
It's a story. It's a global story of imperial power.
Was it?
And it's interestingly enough, often gets used by, you know, the comprador here to just project it onto people resisting that. That, oh, it's a sectarian state, blah, blah, blah. You know, like it's nuts. It's nuts. Like the US empire is funding all kinds of Sunni Salafis and like Sunni jihadis, essentially, and also Kurdish Sunnis. And in the name of sort of creating while at the same time, like, you know, so-called activists and compradors are speaking out and saying that, oh, you know, this is a Shiite dominated state and blah, 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 blah. Like it's like the whole machine is in place in Ireland in terms of like how you can see power use its flex. And in lieu of using, like, because in theory, right, the British could have just occupied the entire island. If they really wanted to, they could have just occupied it and kept it. They did leave for a reason, right? Like they left, I mean, they partitioned it as they went and kept, you know, and used the tools of settler colonialism, which they had been using all this time, obviously. But like, I feel like that's when their settler colonial harvest, that's when they reaped it with the partition and said that, okay, these are our people now. And this gives us an excuse to station our whatever, you know.
Yeah, and that allows, and you know, it's the exact same tactic of Palestine, where you divide and rule. You know, the 26 county state did not leave the Brits' economic sphere or political sphere of influence. The project of Irish independence was still totally within the Brits, and it's the movement from, and everybody listening to this will know, from maybe the high point of old European imperialism into neocolonialism, into whatever you want to call this, the thing that we're living in now, where the state might have formal, quote unquote, legal independence, but economically, but politically, there's still a few hegemons who operate the world markets and the political systems to their advantage.
Right, the elites of that newly supposed sovereign state are in line with the old, like, hegemony, and that relationship and that update, it's like an updated version, like imperialism 2.0.
Yeah.
And again, once again, the Irish are on the vanguard of that experience as well, of like the technical, I guess, evolution of imperialism into neo-colonialism or neo-imperialism. And once again, the Irish are there at ground floor.
The thing you said about jihadis makes, because I was actually wondering recently, like, why is it that evangelical Protestantism is such a thing for the unionist population? And you're saying it makes total sense, right, in terms of cultivating that kind of that level of religious fervor. It makes for kind of a level of ideological sway that you're just not going to replicate any other sort of way. Yeah, it's interesting. Anyway, so Ulsterization changes the character of the conflict into exactly what you're saying. In response to a bar being bombed in a loyalist area, you then have a loyalist paramilitary bombing a Catholic area. And particularly during the ceasefire, when the IRA aren't supposed to be engaging British Army targets, this means that the sectarian nature of the attacks can really start to ramp up and dictate the nature of the conflict. And this means that the conflict internationally can be represented as something that's taking place between two irreconcilable ethnic or religious groups, and the British can present themselves as honest brokers or even peacemakers. And Tommy McCarney, in his book about the Provisional IRA, draws the comparison between the Brit strategy here and the one that's adapted in Malaya, Kenya, and Cyprus, containing the insurrection while playing a long game in ensuring the transfer of capital to a regime favorably disposed to British and to international capital. And of course, you have guerrilla campaigns drawing their most significant resources from popular support. So loyalist death squads, the kind of the Ulsterization that I've just been talking about, it provides the best means of attacking the civilian population. There is actually, yeah, just to put a tag on that, that Robert W. White, in his book of the Provisional IRA, just since you mentioned casualties, he presents a statistical breakdown in order to prove that the provos were waging a war of struggle against Crown forces, and whereas loyalist paramilitaries targeted Catholic civilians, particularly towards the end of the conflict. So making the point that the loyalist war was sectarian while the IRA's one was not. Killings of Protestant civilians obviously took place, and they were often brutal, and made the kind of support that would have been more easily accessible among Irish people in the 26 counties more complicated. But consistently, figures among the leadership, such as O'Brady and McKee, disagreed with such actions. And I think it points the way in which individuals or individual units had a lot of autonomy to conduct their own operations. But certainly the number of security forces killed by the IRA shrank as the 70s went on. And this is all because of this Ulsterization strategy and the greater sophistication of the occupying forces in doing what they're going to do.